your daughter, your son. Cause you know inside we all are one.
David Powell is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he will be dead. This is Execution Watch. Texas no longer has public hangings, but we'll witness the legal homicide by lethal injection of David Powell in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host, Ray Hill. Legal analyst, Robert Rosenberg. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Gloria Rubeck. Interviewer in Huntsville, Dennis Longmire. And a special guest, John Hallway, attorney and co-author of Killing Time, a book about one man's 18-year struggle from death row to freedom following his wrongful conviction. The Execution Watch begins.
You're listening to radio station KPFD, Houston, the HD2 channel. My name is Ray Hill. The name of the show is Execution Watch. Elizabeth Stein produces a show every time someone is executed in the state of Texas, and actually we've had occasion to cover the execution in other states when it was possible to do that. We keep an eye on execution because our initial concern was that not enough people paid any attention to the serious business of killing people on death row. Texas death row, as Elizabeth explained in the introduction, is the most active in the Western world and has been that for a long time. What is happening now is Elizabeth is making connection with Gloria Rubeck, a person who covers the vigils outside of the death chamber in Huntsville. Before the show is over, we're going to be talking to several people. Hello? Gloria, are you there? Gloria?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, what's going on in Huntsville?
I'm waiting for my friends across the street. The media has gone across. We have a huge crowd of people here, maybe 50 people from around the state, David's baby brother, his stepmother, I'm not sure if his sister's here, Quakers from Houston and Austin, abolitionists, people from Huntsville, tourists who, a man and his two sons who were camping nearby, drove by and said they were sure sorry that this was happening. The cops were allowed to stand right in front of the Walls unit as the witnesses went in for the victim's family. A lot of them have dispersed, although a few of them are still under their tent. A band of, I don't know who they were, motorcycle nuts, have driven by a few times with their revving of their motors and generally being obnoxious. I heard that they escorted the cops into town.
Well, now, Gloria, I'm familiar with the geography up there, but the listeners may not be. You said that the officers who are no doubt organized by the Austin Police Department and were bussed up.
Austin Police Association.
Police Association and were bussed up. Now, the death chamber is inside the walls, opposing buildings. One side is the old Walls unit, largely cells that are no longer used in the front of it. where O. Henry, the short story writer, lived, and that is juxtapositioned across the street from the old administration building. And then there is kind of an open space.
Oh, right. I'm going to interrupt you for just 1 minute because David's friends are walking across the street, and I'm going to say something on the bullhorn to them.
Okay. And so while Gloria is doing that, I can
David
explain.
Powell.
I can.
Allie, Kathy, Jude, Sissy, we are with you. We love you, and we thank you for being with David this evening.
And that's a tough one, but Elizabeth wanted to be sure and get that on the air, so thank you for that.
Oh, okay.
And the police, and did you say the witnesses for the victim crossed the street in the
I had never seen that before. Yeah. Apparently it happens before 5 o'clock when we're never here, but for some reason today people started gathering at 4 o'clock, so we actually got to see them go in.
Okay, so they all come from the same building and cross the street.
I guess so. That was a new one.
And then are the police still bivouacked in front of the front door, or are they down at the other end of the block?
No, they're down the street under their white canopy.
Okay, they're the other end of the block.
Yeah, and the Fox reporter from Austin said that there was some 150 of them here. And, you know, they have a block of hotel rooms. And
okay, before I leave you, Gloria, you know David.
Yes, I do.
And David has spent 30 years on death row. Do you have any? 32 years on death row. Have you any comments?
What David did as a very horribly drug-addicted kid. Unfortunately, for those of us that grew up in the 60s, drugs were everywhere. I'm glad I fooled around and didn't get addicted. Unfortunately, David did. But Ray, he is a brilliant man. He graduated at 15 as valedictorian, went to UT as a child into the honors program with hopes of being a doctor. One of the people that his friends got to go visit him is a woman in Houston who worked at NASA, who was a mathematician. Because David wanted that kind of mental stimulation, whatever mathematicians do. So he was a brilliant man. What happened when he killed that cop was an aberration. It's not that he's changed. It's just that one act was something so out of character and was not David because of the drugs.
Okay, Gloria, Robert and I are going to discuss the case.
Okay.
And we'll hear from you if anything else happens up there.
Okay.
Bye-bye. And that was Gloria Ruback. She is a regular on this show and a regular on the prison show, which we do on Friday nights here on KPFT on a regular broadcast channel. Robert Rosenberg is with me. Robert, the first thing that strikes me is this man has been there 32 years, and we've been executing people after 6 or 7 or 5 years lately. Why this long of a time in this case?
Well, I would say that part of it is the reluctance of the lower courts to actually follow the law is probably the primary reason. Mr. Powell was originally convicted, I think, in 1978, and then that conviction was overturned due to bad jury issues, I believe by the U.S. Supreme Court, because the lower courts wouldn't deal with the issue. They sent it back for retrial. He was retried in, I believe, 91, where, again, they gave bad jury issues. And so then he was ultimately retried again in, I believe, 98, just on the sentencing, because in the interim, they didn't have to, the law changed so they didn't have to retry somebody for both guilt and innocence and sentencing. And Texas, as everywhere, is a bifurcated proceeding in a death penalty case where they first assess guilt and innocence, and then the jury is comes back and hears a separate trial on punishment, where they have to answer questions such as, did David pose a future danger to society, which is really what the last, I guess, 12, 13 years has been focused on, and that David apparently has been a model prisoner for most of the 32 years. And the argument has been, well, you need to, rather than have the jury speculate on whether or not he posed a future danger to society, the fact is he didn't pose a future danger because he's proven he's not a future danger. He has lived, as high a quality of life one can live in prison. He has lived it from everybody has, who knows him or written about him, has said. There doesn't seem to be anybody other than the policemen's union who really seems to support the execution of David Powell.
So this is the case that comes down to ignore the facts. We've got political pressure here. Is that fair?
I would say it's probably fair, and there's also from the start. I mean, I from what I could gather from the previous, you know, I reviewed the different court proceedings, and of course I couldn't ask the prosecutor, but one of the big issues in the case was that David was with his girlfriend at the time, and I don't know, maybe you know how to pronounce her name, Mignette.
Okay.
Who was driving the car, and there were some drugs in the car, there were weapons in the car, including a hand grenade.
Mm-hmm.
And she was pulled over for speeding. The officer called in to find out if there were any outstanding warrants, and I guess I will say I was a little bit surprised to learn that they had a computer system back in 1978 when this happened, and the officer couldn't get the information from the computer system fast enough, and so he let them go, and then a few seconds afterwards, whoever was at the headquarters said, oh, there's an outstanding misdemeanor warrant for David Powell. So he pursued them, and then there was a shootout, and at some point somebody threw the hand grenade at some other officers. There were no eyewitnesses. There were, I guess you could say, auditory witnesses who were in their house, and they rushed to the aid of the police officer, and he kept saying, the girl shot me, is what their testimony was. I don't think there was a lot of question that both David Powell and his girlfriend shot at the police officer.
No, and it could, and at best it's a law party situation.
And it was. But she was apparently, I don't know if she was charged with that murder.
She served 4 years.
But she served 4 years for the attempted murder of another officer who for throwing the grenade.
Which
she was charged in the law of parties rather than as the actual perpetrator of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
Later on in the proceedings, when she was up for parole, many, many, many police officers and the prosecutor wrote the parole board saying that she should not get parole because she's an evil person. She threw a grenade at the police officer, tried to kill him, and did all these other things, which then they also tried to attribute to David as the one who actually committed those same acts.
Oh, okay.
And so there is some question. I mean, I don't know David. I haven't spoken to him. But everything I've read, I wouldn't get the impression, or I wouldn't come to the conclusion that if I was to speak to him, he would deny his role in this man's death.
Furman,
I mean, he has owned up to it, you know.
The Furman case resulted in moratorium and executions nationwide, and that was kind of lifted in 78, 77?
This was probably one of the early cases.
One of the early cases.
And so this is one I think 70, actually, for some reason, I think 73 is when they reenacted the death penalty in Texas.
But at any rate, this would have had to have been one of the first.
Right, and I'm assuming that they did not go after the girlfriend as the actual perpetrator of the murder, because I would suspect that they probably thought it would be easier to convict him as a male.
Mm-hmm.
And she benefited from being a female. I do believe if she was a male, she would have been executed by now, even if she only had the limited role. Again, in the law of parties, they would have charged her equally in the death of a police officer in 1978.
Sure.
And so, you know, it's kind of curious to me how, I mean, I shouldn't say curious because it happens all the time, where the jury hears these witnesses say on his, you know, he made dying declarations that the girl shot him.
Yeah.
But for some reason, since they're not presented with the girl to convict, they go with the guy that they are presented with.
Well, I mean, all of this is really the decision of the district attorney of Tribus County.
Absolutely. And the bottom line is it really doesn't matter if he pulled the trigger or not, because under the law of parties,
he would have been
equally guilty.
Right.
So it doesn't really matter. And so in the last 12 years, it's really focused on, and at his sentencing trial, after the first two convictions were overturned, the lawyers, from what I can gather from the opinions, made some tactical errors. Because they stood there and made an opening statement that they're not going to contest any of the facts of the case. That whatever the prosecutor says, they're going to accept as the truth. And then the prosecutor vilified David Powell and denied that the woman threw the hand grenade, denied that she had anything to do with it, really. She was the young, sweet, you know, girl who
She'd already done her time anyway.
She'd done her time. She testified against him. It was all his fault. She was shocked, appalled, couldn't believe it. She ran from the scene, terrified. She ran from the car. Well, you know, here you had, it was many, I forgot the number, but it was like maybe 50 or so more letters that she had thrown the hand grenade and shot the guns.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't matter. And, you know, that's one of the things that prosecutors are allowed to do, is argue in different trials completely opposite.
They can move the gun
positions.
Around. Move the
it
gun
doesn't
around
matter. And what they said, what they said the month before when they were prosecuting, you know, the accomplice. This is this trial, and that's what counts.
And judges just let them get away with that?
They seem to.
Do judges frequently have reason to know that?
Well, sometimes they sit in both trials, and one would assume they paid some attention. And hopefully the lawyer would point it out to them, you know, but some don't. I mean, I'm sure there are many people who've been tried.
From looking at Mr. Powell's cases, can you tell whether or not he was adequately represented?
I can't tell for sure. I would say that it was and one of the things that was pointed out in after the Fifth Circuit ruled on the sentencing hearing, Dick Burr, who I believe is going to be on maybe, who's been representing him in his habeas, filed a petition for panel rehearing and pointed out several significant incorrect statements of fact
in the opinion itself
that didn't even seem like they were in dispute.
Mm-hmm.
But that the facts had been altered to fit the final conclusion.
That would be errors made by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals itself or by lower courts.
They could have twisted it, or the law clerks who write the opinions. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how these decisions are made. But, you know, just some basic facts that, that you know, were obviously not correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, now...
And I don't think... I would imagine there was a bit of fatigue in the courts about David Powell, and they probably just didn't want to hear about him anymore.
There is that. That the courts actually get tired of listening to the same case over and over again.
They do, and what probably the public or people who don't do this kind of work are aware of is that the courts all the way up the line follow the case as it's going up there.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets to the Supreme Court, it's not the first time they've heard about David Powell, and not just from his earlier trips to the Supreme Court, but they have been tracking it from when it was in state court and the conviction was, you know, was obtained, or the death sentence was obtained. Somebody apparently has assigned that, because I've gotten calls from, you know, from the clerks before the case is even there,
mm-hmm.
wanting to know about the, certain things. And I had one case where the it was still in state court, and the client wrote the federal courts and said I wasn't doing anything on his behalf, and he was worried. Well, I wasn't doing anything because the case was at the Court of Criminal Appeals, sitting there waiting for the judges to make a ruling. There wasn't anything I could do, mm-hmm. but I had done everything that needed to be done.
And they don't have any timelines on when they do stuff or not, right?
No, they don't, which is also why there's so many delays. And what made to the public seem like David Powell is dragging it out, we have no idea how long it sat in various courts because the judge didn't want to rule on it.
Now, on the last go-round, the jury did not have to determine guilt or innocence, but only rehear the punishment.
Correct.
How do you do that without going through every
fact
detail?
Well, they can do that in a punishment trial. They can put on facts of the crime. I think we talked last time I was here about whether or not the facts of the actual crime can are sufficient to prove future dangerousness.
Yeah.
And in fact, in this case, they basically were, because until David Powell was involved in this incident, he had no criminal record, he had no history of violence, and he didn't have one after.
Mm-hmm.
So really all they had were the facts of the case.
That's all they based their decisions on.
Right, and I think if you shoot a police officer, it's probably enough.
Yeah, this...
And if you're driving around with hand grenades and automatic weapons...
That certainly calls for,
you know,
suspicion.
Right.
But this... Normally, a case this old, probably, if it had not been for the police officer element, chances are we wouldn't be here.
I think we would have been here a long time ago. Because of the police officer element, I think that David Powell maybe got more attention than others who... I mean, I'm assuming by that you mean that he would be... have been convicted of some kind of crime.
Yeah, some kind of crime.
Some kind of murder.
Some kind of murder.
But let's say of a 7-Eleven clerk.
Yeah, but if after his behavior on death row for 30 years uh-huh. had been exemplary and nonviolent, if it weren't for the police element, they may have backed off and we'd have
Well, I think if Dennis Longmire is going to be on the phone... we should ask him, because Dennis has a history of testifying in capital cases as an expert witness on prison issue, prison mm-hmm. and incarceration
in
issues.
What happens in prison stuff?
And I believe he's of the theory, based on his research, that most people on death row are extremely nonviolent, and we've discussed this before, where. And in David's case, it also seems true, when drugs are taken out of his life and he is not on his own to make bad decisions, he actually can be a very productive, useful person. So I don't think that the state of Texas is ready, as is if David is executed already, to say, well, somebody living on death row in a peaceful way and following all the rules is going to get off death row alive. You know, Carla Faye Tucker had the same argument. You know, well, my life was screwed up because of drugs, and I'm not on them anymore, and I married a preacher, and I've been a good citizen.
Yeah, and even the detective in the case, Mosier, who was the detective and a friend of mine, went up and spoke up for Carla Faye's clemency. It just didn't happen. And actually, we're over time a little bit. There's something going on in Huntsville. We don't know what, because okay, and no report from Huntsville.
Well, I think Carla Faye Tucker's case is very analogous to this one, and that, you know, on many counts, you know, she. Although, other than, I mean, my recollection is Carla Faye Tucker had been a fairly abused child, or had a much harsher upbringing or lack of upbringing, let's say, than David Powell seems to, because he was a star student in high school. But they fell into a life of drugs. They found themselves in a very dangerous, you know, life situation. They end up committing a, you know, in her case, what sounded like a much bloodier and horrific murder, you know, just the actual facts of it. I mean, I think shooting somebody from a distance is a little bit detached.
Yeah.
And as I recall, she stabs some...
Robert, do you think that the advent of drug courts and mental health courts will... is that any indication we're going to be looking at these issues in any different light from what we have traditionally looked at them?
I don't have any idea. I mean, I don't think that... I think it probably depends on your location. In Texas, I believe people are still going to want the death penalty. They just
I don't doubt about the death penalty, but you take David Powell. If David Powell had a misdemeanor offense, apparently there was a warrant for him. If in the induction into the jail system in that case, he had been ushered to a drug court where a judge recognized that there was a drug issue here and had sent him for treatment rather than to just let him go out on bond and get into more trouble.
Could have saved the police officer's life.
Could have intervened here. Yeah. And then the other situation is if you have someone who is so stewed on drugs or for any reason that they're not in their good senses and the court system kicks them through the gate into a mental health court where they look at these issues in a little more medical, rational way.
You know, it's a good start, but then is there funding that is adequate to do the follow-up? I mean, you know, we're here, you know, close to the corner of Westheimer and Montrose.
Sure.
And anytime, day or night, you can find 25 people in the immediate vicinity of the corner who are...
in the drug trade.
What?
In the drug trade.
Not just in the drug trade, but completely lost.
Yeah.
You know, their lives have been wasted, you know, due to drugs in some way or another. I mean, if you go sit at Starbucks on the patio around the corner, you know, people who obviously are, their life is a wreck.
Yeah.
You know, are there, and the truth is there's nowhere for them to go. There's... and stay long enough to get real help. So I think the drug courts are a good idea. I think mental health, you know, care is a good idea, but I don't think that the people of the United States anywhere are willing to fund it in an adequate way so that it works.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to do is trying to find some optimistic flash of light that would give me more hope that there's not going to be a continuous string of David Powells. David Powell has now taken 32 years on death row to reach the point where they're actually going to kill him, and they are doing that even as we speak.
Gloria's on the line.
And Gloria's on the line. I don't know which line. Did we lose her? So we're going to go get her back on the line. And so, Gloria...
Well, I wish I was a more optimistic person. But, when you have... I just think it's a bigger picture, right, about how we deal with everything in terms of, let's say the unemployment benefits. Well, the Democratic Congress last week felt it was impolitic to extend benefits for the unemployed. They don't want to pass any kind of stimulus package which would put people back to work in meaningful ways. I don't think it's a meaningful way to hire somebody as a census worker for 3 weeks and call it a boost in unemployment. I mean, a reduction in unemployment.
Well, we have Gloria back. Gloria, what has happened?
Okay, I'm just introducing Sissy to the crowd. Sissy, would you say a few words?
Who is that?
Sissy Franto's there.
Ray.
Yeah, I can't hear that.
Okay, hang on. Let me put the phone over here. I'm sorry, I was hugging Kathy Cox. It's crime to stab and stated two families in the community left shocked. And can you hear that?
Yes.
Okay. But to snuff out his life now is a crime against humanity.
Right.
And I would like to add, this is a death camp.
Right.
Keep that in mind. From this day forward. And I can only think that this is a milestone for the repeal of the death penalty.
Yeah.
And that must be our effort and our work from now on. Thank you.
Okay, that was Sissy.
That was Sissy Ferrantho. And are you also emceeing and talking to
her? Yes, that's the problem. Catherine Cox is with you.
Let Catherine bless her heart.
Okay. And who has supported him all these years, and we want to thank you for coming so much. God bless you.
As
Lord, have mercy. And I want to thank Catherine Cox. She has been visiting the men on death row for, 30 some odd years every week. She drives from Dallas. She drove to the Ellis unit. Now she drives even farther to the Polunsky unit. She visits. She brings them kindness. She buys them treats. She gives them spiritual advice. And she witnesses them being murdered. Would anybody else like to say a few words for David? Okay.
Are you back with
us? All right, Ray, I'm sorry.
No.
Hard sharing a rally and talking and being Lois Lane.
Well, if you can catch Catherine before she leaves, be sure and give her my love.
Okay.
And Sissy and I exchange that all the time. But you had a good crowd.
Yes, we did.
It seemed to be a relatively quiet crowd.
Well, they're Quakers. They said they weren't as rowdy as I was, but I could get as rowdy as I wanted.
Well, yeah, Quakers will let you get away with it. Well, is Dennis or Dick Burr there?
Yes, Dick is over here. You want to talk to
Dick? Let me chat with Dick Burr for a minute.
Okay. All right. I don't know where Dennis went, but here's Dick.
He went to teach a class, producer.
That's right, he had a class. Would you talk to Ray Hill?
Yeah.
Okay, here's Dennis. Dick.
Dick?
Hey, Ray.
Hello, Dick. Thank you for being on Execution Watch tonight.
Sure.
You were an appellate attorney for Mr. Powell, right?
Yes, I represented David for about 8 years.
And what was it like working with David?
David was a great challenge. On one hand, he always was a step ahead of me in terms of what he thought needed to be done, and had great ideas. He was a delight to work with on one hand because he was so knowledgeable about his case and the law surrounding it. He was a wonderful human being to be with. I generally represent people with all my heart and soul, but I don't usually become friends with them. David is just a couple of years younger than me, and I did become friends with David, and he with me. And it's a huge loss for me, just personally. It's a greater loss, much greater loss for all the people on death row that he was friends with, he supported, he loved, he taught, he mentored, he insisted that they do their exercise to keep their health up. David will be just sorely, sorely missed in the community that he was beloved in and that he did so much good in.
Thank you. Dick, you don't have to tell us your feelings. We can get it in the character of your voice. Thank you very much for being on Execution
Watch.
Thank you. And that was Glory Ruback and Dick Burr. Yes, please.
Actually, a little bit of brighter news.
Okay.
Surprisingly coming from me.
That's right.
Much to my surprise, and I think probably some other people's surprise, in the last few weeks, the Supreme Court has issued, let's say, some rays of hope.
Sure.
In the way they handle death penalty cases. One of them
They lifted just a killer deadline.
That was yesterday.
Yesterday.
In a case out of Florida. And the lawyer had not paid attention to his client, despite his client's repeated efforts to stay in contact and urge his lawyer to file the appropriate pleadings. And the lawyer missed the deadline. And under, you know, in most situations, the courts would have just said, and even last week, mm-hmm. I'm sure the Supreme Court probably had an opportunity to rule on a similar case and ruled the other way. I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing that in the last year they've had an opportunity to rule on the same issue and didn't grant relief. But yesterday they issued an opinion that says in certain circumstances, if a lawyer misses the deadline, the habeas petitioner, the inmate, is not the one who's going to suffer due to the lawyer's incompetence, which is a big change.
And it was 7-2.
It was.
And which is significant.
I hadn't read the entire opinion, but in the New York Times reporting of it today, it sounded like Alito was the most bothered by...
Alito wrote the opinion.
He wrote a concurrence because he had a stronger view about it than the other...
a conservative.
Sides. Right.
So this was a conservative written opinion. Now, the dissenters were Thomas and Scalia, which is sometimes no surprise. We have John Holloway. John?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
I can.
John, you were a representative to John Thompson?
Yes, I've written a book about his story and exoneration from death row in Louisiana.
Now this is a Louisiana case, so he would have been on death row in Angola.
That's correct.
Well, I have been there.
It's an interesting place.
Well, just the road to get Angola Road itself is a phenomena.
Yes, the Snake Road is it's quite an image and something that actually features in the book.
I'm sorry, but I need to know more about that. You can't just throw that out without...
Well, it's the Angola Road is actually a mountain road on flat land.
Okay.
Is that fair, Mr.?
I think it is, yes. It's, the prison is positioned in an interesting way, and it's about a 20-mile-long stretch of road that snakes back and forth with lots of kind of hairpin turns, to your point, on flat land with very thick underbrush around it, and it would be a very challenging thing for somebody to try and get through any other way but the road, and the road is the only way in.
Well, that provides
That helps Robert with his visual. I've been down Angola Road with Helen Prejean, so that was a double trip. What was your interest in Mr. Thompson's case?
Well, I had practiced law in Philadelphia and actually knew John's lawyers, Michael Banks and Gordon Cooney, mm-hmm. and had been following the case for a number of years. As you may know, John was arrested in 1985 and charged with the murder of a prominent white Manhattan New Orleans hotel executive. He was convicted on the basis of some very vague, non-specific eyewitness testimony that saw an African-American man with a gun running away, and plea bargain testimony given by another person who was arrested with him, in that sense not unlike the tragedy that we're dealing with today in Texas. John was put on death row in 1985 in Angola, and Michael Banks and Gordon Cooney, two white attorneys from Philadelphia, took his case on in 1988. They represented him in his appeals pro bono. In 1999, after over 10 years of fighting, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear John's final appeal, and Gordon and Michael traveled to Angola and went down the snake road to tell John that there was nothing that they could do. All of his options were exhausted, and he was going to be executed in about 4 weeks. That would have been John's seventh death warrant.
Mercy.
Literally leaving the prison, they got a voicemail from a private investigator they had hired as a last-ditch effort, who turned up some evidence that had been buried by the New Orleans DA's office that allowed them to, it was exculpatory evidence that should have been disclosed in 1984 and instead was buried. And it allowed them to reopen the case and get John a new trial. It took four more years till 2003 to get the new trial, but ultimately John was retried and acquitted on all counts after only about 30 minutes of jury deliberation.
I'm not familiar with the case. Was that in the federal courts that the case was overturned, or in state court?
I'm having trouble hearing you.
Where did the overturn happen, in federal or state?
The overturn happened so that there was a petition for a new trial in Louisiana state court that was rejected by the trial judge.
Mm-hmm.
They appealed that to the Louisiana Fourth Circuit, who granted the new trial in state court. And John was acquitted in state court.
Okay, so the actual action was state action.
Yes.
Okay, I am talking with John Holloway. He is the author of a pretty weighty book, Killing Time, and it you actually wander in and out of this case and talk about a broader incidence of capital punishment litigation, don't you?
Yes, well, it was a capital punishment case, and I think that was something that really drew me to the story, was the opportunity to take the capital punishment subject, which is so broad and important, as you say, but to boil it down to an individual person's situation. Mm-hmm. So that you can really get a sense of how it impacts people's lives.
There seems to be a struggle that is common among lawyers that write books related to this subject, is you're trying to teach the rest of us something that you know absolutely we do not understand.
Well, I think certainly when you're dealing with issues of legal procedure, there's a challenge in making a book that is interesting and deals with that. But with capital punishment cases, the legal procedure ends up being very, very important. And so the 10 years that Michael and Gordon were fighting through the legal system, through the appeal system, to try and get John's case overturned, there were some really important issues that they were dealing with. They were dealing with whether or not a jury knew that certain people that were giving testimony had been promised a reward by the prosecutors and the New Orleans Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
They were dealing with whether one of the jurors who originally voted against capital punishment and would have prevented the death penalty from being administered had been pressured by the judge and the jury in open court to change her vote. And there are a lot of really important issues about how these trials are run that impact on the issue of whether we can administer this kind of punishment on another human being. And ultimately, while Michael and Gordon reached, while the right result was reached and John's life was saved, mm-hmm. and he was found innocent, I don't think you can really fairly say that the system worked here, because all of the legal machinery continued to reject John's appeals, even though there were a lot of both factual and legal reasons why that shouldn't have been the case.
Well, the very existence of the severe punishment of execution leaves open an awful lot of opportunity for incredible, unimaginable things to happen that just defy logic.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'm sure I'm not saying anything that you haven't heard, thought, or said many times before, but in my mind, the ultimate punishment would have to require the ultimate knowledge that what we're doing is to somebody who committed the crime, and I don't see how that could ever be done. I just don't think you could ever know it enough to administer that punishment on anybody.
John Holloway, I have with me attorney Robert Rosenberg, who is also in appellate practice. Robert?
I was just curious, from your experience basically living outside of the Fifth Circuit, but becoming intimately and having intimate knowledge of how the Fifth Circuit works, how would you say it's the same as
the Seventh Circuit, for instance?
Well,
they execute people from Philadelphia too, don't
not
they?
Too many. And aren't there a lot of people on death row in Pennsylvania?
How colloquial is all of this?
Well, so there are certainly a lot of people on death row in Pennsylvania. The reason that in this case Michael and Gordon took a case in Louisiana was that in the late 80s when they were taking the case on, the governor of Pennsylvania had said he would not sign any death warrants. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, there is a death row in Pennsylvania, and yes, there were inmates on it at that time, but Michael and Gordon wanted to take on a case where they felt that they were actually had the potential to do some good and prevent somebody from being executed. In Pennsylvania, that was simply not happening. There was a moratorium.
Well, you know, things are not sweetness and light up there either, because I happen to be a friend of Hurricane Carter's. And he could go on for days about what happens in Pennsylvania.
Sure, but
certainly, yeah. No, I mean, I guess I certainly don't mean to suggest that that all is right in the world in any state where there's the death penalty. But certainly, I think at that period of time, Louisiana had executed 7 men in the previous 18 months.
Well, I guess
They took on the case, whereas in Pennsylvania, the governor had made as a matter of policy that he was not going to sign any death warrants during his term.
Okay.
I didn't just say that. I mean, my question is the which I think anybody who does habeas work in anywhere in the country is probably finds it very frustrating when you get an opinion back that you know is completely wrong on the facts and the law. But
are you getting that, John?
I am. Yes.
Okay.
But I was just curious if the lawyers that handled it in the Fifth Circuit, in the federal courts and in the state courts, you know, find it less frustrating maybe to work in another jurisdiction where maybe there's an appreciation for, you know, Brady or, you know, all kinds of things that don't seem to matter at all here in the Fifth Circuit.
Well, it's a hard question to answer. I'm not sure that Michael or Gordon, who took on this case pro bono, have done much habeas work in other jurisdictions. In fact, Michael is doing another case in Texas, and so he's probably feeling some of the same frustrations that you're expressing here. You know, often they're dealing with federal law in those situations, and so the circuit to circuit or interpretation of the case law, I think everybody's trying to interpret a lot of the same cases, but I guess I would hesitate to conjecture that there are a lot of circuits that are better at interpreting Brady, for example, than the Fifth Circuit, though that doesn't necessarily mean that those interpretations are to everybody's satisfaction.
John, Gordon and Michael, what do they do when they're not commuting to this war?
So Gordon and Michael are both very successful and very talented corporate
civil practitioners.
Michael specializes in employment discrimination and labor law mm-hmm. cases. Gordon specializes in some very complex securities and class action cases.
Okay, so actually they're from other places on the picket line. These are not silk stocking lawyers. These are hardworking lawyers working for somebody's rights.
I think so, yeah. They take the representation of people who need their help very seriously, and they pour their hearts and souls into their cases. It was a real honor to be able to tell a story of good lawyering.
And what kind of law do you practice?
Well, I represent a corporation predominantly in the biotech space in San Francisco these days, though I have done a variety of different civil litigation and some criminal work as well.
What was it like going out of your natural habitat and becoming an author?
Well, it was exhilarating in a sense. You know, I mean, I think being a writer is something that I've always been interested in doing, and the experience of doing the research, of really getting to know John Thompson, really getting to hear his experiences, of meeting some of the other people who were involved in the case, and getting to know, you know, the case at a very deep level, and not just from what you can get from the transcripts, was a very meaningful one. And it really, I have to say, it really did, if not change my views, certainly sharpen my views on the problems with capital punishment and the way we administer it, and the way we litigate it, and the procedural challenges that we have there. And so it was very educational, and you know, I felt that I got quite a bit out of it, and I hope that comes through in the book, and that people who read it enjoy reading it as much as I enjoyed writing it.
Well, I'm fond of quoting myself. In a recent speech, I said that executions were the great existing and glaring anomaly of our time. Fair?
Yeah, I think that's right, and I've sort of come to the conclusion that the death penalty says more about us as a society than it does about any individual person or the crime that they've committed. And the fact that we are all complicit in this happening is I think a significant black mark on us as a community.
John Holloway, the author of Killing Time. How does one get in touch with you via the net, John?
There's a Facebook page for Killing Time, and I have a blog, Killing Time Book, blogspot.com.
Killing Time Book, blogspot.com. Thank you very much for being on with us tonight, John.
A pleasure.
Bye-bye. And that was a nice gentleman from I've heard of Philadelphia lawyers all of my life. And that actually is one, right?
Okay.
Robert, it's time for you and I to
I wish we'd asked him about what, if anything, happened to Harry Connick Sr.
Oh, okay.
Who obtained the wrongful conviction.
Well, Harry Connick went on to other political things. He went to Congress, didn't he?
Well, yes. The attorneys for John Thompson won a $14 million judgment against Connick. And the Supreme Court has agreed to hear an appeal of that this fall.
I know, but Harry Connick Sr. won't be paying it. The state of Louisiana will be paying it.
The state of Louisiana will be paying it, right?
You know, but I mean, I think I'm curious about it because if you think back to, let's say, the Andrea Yates trial and the two lawyers that put on the false testimony from Park Dietz, the psychiatrist.
Sure.
You know, it took a change of administration before they lost their job.
Mm-hmm. They do circle their wagons here in Harris County.
They do. And, you know, it doesn't really seem to matter much. And I am curious about the geography quite a bit all the time.
Well, apparently this is your natural habitat, and you have to fight and survive here.
It is my natural habitat.
And you know, but whether you're in the courthouse and are you dealing with ticklish issues having to do that, or whether you're over in the houses of legislature or even City Hall, for that matter, where sometimes I work, these are my natural environs, and I am aware of where the bugs are and where the rats lay and the atmosphere, and you have to do that. That's kind of self-defense.
And that's why you wear those thick-soled shoes, isn't
that's
it?
Right. Well, I don't have a foot on the other side of one of those soles, so I'm not worried about that one. They can have that one. What has happened tonight in the last hour? The witnesses for both sides have crossed 12th Street in front of the walls and entered the walls and through it to the death chamber. And tonight, David Lee Powell, who is 59 years old, was killed by the state of Texas for a crime that happened some 32 years ago. You heard Sissy and you heard Gloria and you heard very briefly, Catherine, wonderful people who are political activists in their own rights and concerned about David Lee Powell, explained that on death row he provided services and help and encouragement or the only people around him, which were the other inmates. Made friends with the guards, existed under very difficult circumstances. No normal, rational person would conclude that the man they killed tonight was a danger to society. However, some time ago, he was involved in a horrible crime. A crime that resulted in the death of a police officer and the injuring of others. There were other people involved, but because of the roll of the die, the criminal justice system, he took the hit, and others, perhaps just as culpable, if not more so, missed the bullet. David Lee Powell is dead. Revenge has been taken. We leave it to you, the listener, to decide whether that revenge was taken correctly or wrongfully on the right person or the wrong person. We don't have the wisdom to share with you what we think about that because we are just deliverers of messages. You are the person that has to process and decide it. Every time Texas executes somebody, some of us gather in the studio to try to shed light on that case and bring you other information about the phenomena of executions in Texas and perhaps occasionally elsewhere. Robert Rosenberg has been wrestling with those monsters for some time as an appellate-level attorney, and sometimes he can get cynical because his rewards are not always the kindest and his efforts are not always successful, and it is not recognizes. So he's a little more jaded than I am. I'm always the eternal optimist because all I got to do is a radio show. And I am more hopeful than he. But then, of course, I'm not in the pit. The show happens because of the hard work of Elizabeth Stein. She is our producer, and it takes her a lot of effort and work to put the elements together, make sure the station is up and running to carry the show, and that we get connected to Otis's computer so that it shows up on their archive. Her work is indefatigable, and she makes it happen every time. Beyond that, we have engineering staff, and I don't even know who engineered tonight. We have it right down here.
Kirsten Otis.
Has been doing our engineering tonight. But, of course, he's working within a matrix laid for us by the wizard Otis McClay. And Kirsten Otis is the one that's activating that wisdom tonight. The theme music that we begin with is Victoria Panetti, and she can be further studied on a MySpace page, which she titles She Monster. So it's MySpace.com/SheMonster. We're going to be back very quickly in a couple of weeks. I'm not going to be back, but the rest of the staff will. On June the 30th, Jonathan Green is scheduled to be executed by Texas, followed the next day on July 1st by Michael Perry. Execution Watch already has information about their cases up, and you can get information about what we're going to do in advance or listen to what we do after we do it on executionwatch.org. I am Ray Hill. Thank you for listening. We hope not to see you until the end of the month, and you're listening to radio station KPFT Houston HD2 channel. Good night.
Young man fell in with the wrong crowd. We all done things of which we ain't proud. He may have not been right in the mind. That don't pardon his heinous crime. But David Lee.
The World Cup from the Rainbow Nation on the BBC.
Hello.
this is Ros Atkins, and I'm in Soweto for World Cup Have Your Say. It's the program where you share your views on the tournament we're all watching. Whether you want to talk about the action on the pitch or events off it, World Cup Have Your Say is the place to get it off your chest. World Cup Have Your Say. Listen online or on your mobile at 8GMT at bbcworldservice.com.
Every Wednesday, Heart and Soul explores the role of faith, spirituality and religion in our everyday lives. And if you miss an episode, you can download it as a weekly podcast at bbcworldservice.com.
This is the BBC in Beijing.
Kampala.
Reykjavik.
Delhi.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.